It's time now on KSMU for Making a Difference, stories of hope and help produced in cooperation with the Community Foundation of the Ozarks. Today, a conversation about rural schools between longtime friends Arthur Mallory and Gary Funk. Arthur Mallory is a former president of Missouri State University and Commissioner of Education for the state of Missouri. Gary Funk is a former school principal and president of the Community Foundation of the Ozarks. He currently serves as director of the Wisconsin-based Rural Schools Collaborative. We pick up the conversation as Arthur Mallory tells when his father, Dillard, became superintendent of Dallas County Schools.
When we drove into Buffalo in 1944 in August, there was one stoplight out on the highway, on Highway 65, and there was a light on top of the water tower. And those were the lights in town. We'd moved away from the metropolis of Verona, Missouri, where my dad had been superintendent of schools for 10 years, a little bitty town.
You know, Arthur, as you talk about the migration from Verona to Buffalo, it really brings to mind, I don't know of any person that's had the breadth of experiences in public education that you have, you know, from a father that taught some school in Verona to college president to a commissioner. I mean, how, you know, as you reflect back on that, I mean, that's quite a journey.
It is. And my mother and dad started teaching in one-room rural schools. Mother had a 10th grade education when she started teaching. Daddy had an 8th grade education. He passed the county examination when he was in the 7th grade. Both of them did. They didn't know one another. They lived in the same county. Went to the same town school in Hartville, and that's where they met. They passed the county examination, and both of them got a number one certificate. There were three levels of certificates, and if you made a sufficiently high enough score on that county examination, and I used to continue as commissioner of education, I gave that examination. We had people grandfathered in, and I looked back at those exams that my parents took, and there are very few high school or college people who would enjoy taking that test because it was a very complicated test. It was very classical. But if you made a sufficiently high enough score, you could teach in a one-room rural school if you had an eighth grade diploma. And that was back in the day.
You know, you told me and a few others that have been fortunate enough to be there a story about how your father got started as a school teacher, and I always enjoy hearing it. And it's instructive.
I've told that, I guess, because I can't think of anything else to say. But my dad was, on Sunday morning early, he and his dad got up and got in the buckboard wagon, and they went to the community off away from their community. And so they got in the buckboard and went across the countryside and came to the Crossroads store. Went on down the lane and went to the house where he was to board out for a term of school. A term would last maybe 9 months, pretty often 7 or 8 months. It lasted until the money ran out, the state money. And so he went up, knocked on the door of the family, and no one was at home. So they turned around, went back to the store. He went in to see the shopkeeper and said, "Can you tell me about the family that lives down the lane?" And this man looked at this 16-year-old boy and said, "Are you the new schoolmaster?" And Daddy said, "Yes, sir, I'm the school teacher." And he reached out of the cash drawer and he took a key and he gave it to my dad and he said, "The people whom you're looking for are still out for their Sunday activities, but they told me that if you get here before they do, you're to take the key and go inside the house and make yourself right to home." So he thanked the proprietor and went back. The key worked, took his two satchels, one filled with all the clothes he had ever owned and the other filled with all the books he could find, and set them just inside the screen door. It was August. And then he said he took a seat right next to the door. He didn't wander around the house, see what the people owned. He just unimaginatively sat there until the people came home. They came in. He helped unhitch the team, do the evening chores. The mother called and said, "Come on in, the supper's ready." So they ate. The dad was at one end of the table, the mother at another. And my dad was on one side and three little kids who were going to make up the 72-student one-room rural school the next day. They got quiet, and the father said, "We'll ask the schoolmaster to ask the blessing," which he did. And at the conclusion, they took him upstairs and showed him a room where he was going to be by himself. He said it was a corner room, had two windows looking outside, had a closet with a door on it. He'd never seen a closet with a door, and that was impressive. He had a single mantle Aladdin lamp, got a nice white light, and a table and a chair and a bed. He said it's wonderful, and so they left him, and they closed the door, and he sat there, August, at dusk, homesick time, and here this kid started thinking about what was going to happen the next day, and he was wondering, you know, how he's going to teach 72 kids. He knew how many there would be. And then he asked himself a couple of questions. He said, he asked himself, why did they give me the key? They didn't know him. They'd never met him. And then he asked himself, why did they ask me to ask the blessing? Because it's important who asks the blessing in your home with your kids and the family. And he concluded that the reason they gave him the key and the reason they asked him to ask the blessing was because he was a school teacher. And they expected it of him. And that was in his mind from then on. What do you expect? You're the schoolmaster. That was important.
The point that I've always taken from that and what I've always seen, and I've had a great pleasure to work with you in a couple capacities. As a young professor that didn't know anything and was trying to start some programs up at Missouri State that you were kind enough to let wobble around and do stuff. And later, when with your encouragement and support and the support of others, came back to work with the Public Foundation, which is, you know, the Community Foundation of the Ozarks, which because of you and donors and others has grown into, a nifty thing. But the thing that I've always seen with you is this notion of treating people with respect and making them feel good about what they're doing. And then in the end, in education, you know, there's a lot of talk and hyperbole about test scores and achievement. And while those things are important, that sometimes I think we've gotten away from the sense that if you make people feel good and you make people feel like they're responsible for others, that you're going to accomplish a lot more. And some of those other more ephemeral, if you will, things will follow. But whenever you start talking about your dad, I started listening because I knew that was where the advice was. But something that you said to me once that I think impacted me more than anything else is you said one of the most unfortunate things that has happened over the course of American educational history is that we stopped asking the older kids to take responsibility for the younger kids. And when you think about a 16-year-old,
yeah, I think it is true. When my dad started teaching 72 kids in a one-room rural school, he was 16. There were several people in the class who were older than he. He had never had a course in how to teach, but he had the state superintendent's course of study, which gave all of those one-room rural school teachers a direction. At the turn of the century, we had 10,000 school districts in the state of Missouri. Most of them were one-room rural schools. But in those one-room rural schools where the older students would participate in the teaching as well as in the learning, they thrived and good education took place. You know, cross-age tutoring, well, they had that in the one-room rural school. The open classroom, we had that in the one-room rural school. The third graders were listening when the teacher was talking to the fifth graders. And the third graders could help the first graders. Out in rural Missouri, people lived in communities, you know, but they weren't towns. They were, there were probably a couple of churches and a school. And, that was, it made up the community of farms. And, a lot of the older girls in the community from these farms would, go back to school each year. And they were every bit as able to do, the teaching, and learning took place, and learning was focused. And I'm not advocating, you know, go back to the good old days, but I would advocate for asking young people, teenagers, to really be responsible for something.
Paul Theobald, an author and rural historian, talks about intradependence, depending on one another to build school. And that was what happened in one-room schoolhouses, I think. And I'm not a sentimentalist about one-room schoolhouses.
And they were not all the good old days.
They were not the good old days.
No.
But there was a sense of community and a sense of shared responsibility. The Community Foundation of the Ozarks, our board, our staff, our donors were really taking those lessons, Arthur, and creating the Rural Schools Partnership, mm-hmm. which to me, I guess it's a lot of things. It's certainly been about building $30 million in assets to support public education in relatively impoverished small towns. But to me, what the Rural Schools Partnership does in conjunction with the Community Foundation of the Ozarks and what we're trying to do on a larger scale now with our new Rural Schools Collaborative, which is a multi-state effort, is break down those barriers and have communities where elders are engaged with young people and have communities where nonprofits and organizations are a major part of what goes on in a school district and trying to put young people into leadership positions like with our Youth Empowerment Project, which Bridget Dirk still ably runs at Community Foundation of the Ozarks, a process and a plan that I think has done some real good in communities. It's built communities and schools simultaneously.
Well, you know, it's fiction to believe that education, all education takes place in a schoolhouse. We have the kids in public education in Missouri 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 170 plus days per year for 13 years. Most of the time, the child, young person, will spend out of school. Clearly, the most significant teaching that takes place, if it does, and if it will, and if it's focused, is between the child and the parent, between birth to 3 years of age, 5 years of age. All the isms are pretty well established right there. The child has learned whether or not they're going to be obedient to the constituted authority or disobedient, whether they'll share or not share. All the important things that the child will forever and forever keep are pretty well learned by the time the child's five. Thus, the Parents as Teachers program. We created that back in the early 80s simply because I had read a book. Dr. Burton White, a Harvard professor, wrote a book entitled The First 3 Years of Life. And I thought he was right. And we impaneled him, and we started the Parents as Teachers program. And so most of the time for the young high school graduate, most of the time learning has been out of the classroom, in the community, in the home. And that's what part of that that collaborative is trying to push.
You know, your mention as Parents as Teachers, Arthur, I think is worth chewing the cud on here a little bit. When you were commissioner, you know, not just Parents as Teachers, but Missouri was a leading state in so much that was implemented nationally. I mean, the special education legislation that you had in Missouri was the model for the national legislation in Public Law 94-142.
That's right.
And I think that rich history that people need to remember and celebrate, and it gets lost in the morass.
Well, we did, you know, when I became Commissioner of Education in 1971, I decided the best thing I could do would be to listen to a lot of people. And there were many voices out there. We didn't have special education in our schools in 1971. People now can't believe that. They can't believe that, and 71 is a long time ago, but they can't believe that we didn't have what we now have. And so we got 66 groups of people together, all having children. These are adults, all having children with some little phase of special education need. I got them together on the 14th floor of the Jefferson Building in Jefferson City. And after we'd had some coffee and donuts and talked for a while, I said, why don't you trust us and we'll write the definitive special education legislation. That was House Bill 474. Got it passed in one session just to show you how hungry people were to do the right thing. It was passed in one session of the General Assembly without a dissenting vote, with money. And that was unheard of. And so Public Law 94-142, the federal law, was patterned after the Missouri law. Now, I had as little to do with that as anybody. I had lots of people working on it. But you just get people together and talk about it, and they'll come up with the right answers. For 17 years, we had meetings across the state. I would invite 5,000 Missouri citizens to come and visit about a topic. I would select the topic along with my colleagues, and we would do the research on it, and then we would promise the people, if you'll tell us what you want to do about this topic, I promise you, we'll do it. If it requires legislation, we'll ask for it. We'll do what you say. And the reason you can do that is because you trust people, and 5,000 Missouri citizens are not going to make a dumb suggestion.
If you were given advice to whether it was a teacher or a nurse or a young entrepreneur that was emerging from, say, Missouri State University and going back to whether it's Carthage or Ava or Avi, as they say, or West Plains. I mean, what would you suggest that younger professionals or folks that are going into the workforce in these places think about?
My old dad, he was a conservative, believing kind of guy, and he believed in hard work. He believed to get there early, stay late, and clean your tools on your own time. Put more in than you expect to take out. He believed these things, and he impressed all of us. And it was the stuff that makes you a good citizen, that makes you put forth the most you can every day, regardless of whether you're in a small or a large community. And that was important stuff. I would simply say to young people, sit down and review who you are, where you came from, get acquainted with yourself, reacquaint yourself with your family, and be honest, be a hardworking person, and make yourself enjoy your job. I think probably a lot of America goes to work and doesn't enjoy it, and that's a shame. If you can't like the work. And that would be true in school teaching. My mother retired after 43 years of teaching. My dad, 50 years. My wife's a retired teacher. I have a son who's a retired teacher, a daughter who's a retired teacher. Of course, the fact of the matter is, if you can't do anything else, you can always teach school, you know. You can. And we've proven that. But, I think the thing young people need to do is to see to it that they believe. I think believing is important, and believe in the right stuff. And belief will result in action.
The notion that public education stands for something, and that public education in schools, and that notion of civic ownership of the schools was essential to American development. Not always perfect. I mean, unfortunately, many African-American children weren't always allowed to go to school. Unfortunately, for many decades, young women didn't get the opportunity that young men did. But still, every decade gets a little better. One of the things that's encouraging to me is if you open and you look when you go into a place, there's messages there that are strong and they resonate. The little village that my farm is near, Cambridge, was founded by devout Norwegian Lutherans, mm-hmm. who really came over to the United States. Yeah, economic opportunity was part of it, but also really, you know, for a less hierarchical religious freedom and the ability to do things. And they founded these little villages all over what's called the Koshkonong Valley. And they built a lot of churches, a lot of them. Many of which are still there today. But in the village of Cambridge, there's a highest point in town. It is the most prominent place in town. And Arthur, what do you think that those devout, Lutheran, God-fearing folk that came to the United States for religious freedom and economic opportunities built at that highest, most visible place?
Did they put a school there?
They put a school there. And it's still there. And they put that school there because they realized how important it was to the future of those children, that community, to have a good school.
I was walking out of a meeting, And this was back when I was Commissioner of Education, and a television group was out there, and they said, "Well, Mr. Mallory, what can you describe a great, nearly perfect educational program?" And I said, "Sure." And they said, "Well, in 30 seconds, can you do that? We've got a soundbite that we want to use." And I said, "Well, first of all, you have to have access. And that is the taxpayer's responsibility. A bus ride, a good teacher, books, the building, a safe place, access. And number two, you have to have a supportive home. And that's parents who will get their kids to bed at night, having studied their lessons, if they have a home in the homework, getting a good breakfast in the morning, ready to go to school," with a lot of comments about how important the school is. That's the supportive home. But nothing happens unless you have a willing learner. And you create that willing learner so early they can't remember. And if you can have access, supportive home, and a willing learner, you can have a good school anywhere.
And that's the thing that I'm most proud of, I think, is the fact that experiences and leadership from folks like you, Arthur, have come together with the Community Foundation of the Ozarks to create something that all across this region are strengthening those bonds between school and community. And now that folks in other states are beginning to pay attention to and say, you know, how can we build that school on the hill?
That's
so I thank you, you know, for what you've done for me through the years and what you've done for the state, the nation, and also for our region. It's been consequential.
How nice of you, Gary.
Arthur Mallory speaking with his longtime friend and colleague, Gary Funk. Arthur Mallory served as president of Missouri State University from 1964 to 1971 and commissioner of education for the state of Missouri from 1971 to 1987. A former Community Foundation of the Ozarks board member, Arthur Mallory remains an active supporter of the foundation's Rural Schools Partnership. Gary Funk is a former school principal and served as president of the Community Foundation of the Ozarks from 2003 to 2010. He is now the director of the Wisconsin-based Rural Schools Collaborative. Links to and information about the Rural Schools Collaborative and the Community Foundation of the Ozarks Rural Schools Partnership can be found through the Community Foundation of the Ozarks website, cfozarks.org. For Making a Difference, stories of hope and help here on KSMU, I'm Mike Smith.